For Mark Anders, the allotted days were running out swiftly. Soon he must leave the valley and return to the world of men, and a quiet desperation came over him. He had searched the south bank and the steep ground above it. Now he crossed to the north bank and started there all over again. Here, for the first time, he had warning that he was not the only human being in the valley. The first day he came across a line of snares laid along the game trails that led down to the drinking places on the river. The wire used was the same as that he had found on the gangrened leg of the crippled Impala Doe, 18-gauge galvanized mild steel wire, probably cut from some unsuspecting farmer's fence. Mark found 16 snares that day and tore each out, bundled the wire, and hurled it into one of the deeper pools of the river. 2 days later, he came across a log deadfall, so cunningly devised and so skilfully set that it had crushed a full-grown otter. Mark used a branch to lever the log clear and drew out the carcass. He stroked the soft, lustrous chocolate fur and felt again the stirring of his anger. Quite unreasonably, he was developing a strange proprietary feeling for the animals of this valley, and a growing hatred for anyone who hunted or molested them. Now his attention was divided almost equally between his search for his grandfather's grave and for further signs of the illegal trapper. Yet it was almost another week before he had direct sign of the mysterious hunter. He was crossing the river each morning in the dawn to work the north bank. It might have been easier to abandon the camp under the fig trees, but sentiment kept him there. It was the old man's camp, their old camp together, and in any case he enjoyed the daily crossing and the journey through the swampland formed in the crotch of the two rivers. Although it was only the very edge of this watery world that he moved through, yet he recognised it as the very heart of this wilderness, an endless well of precious water and even more precious life, the last secure refuge of so many creatures of the valley. He found daily evidence of the big game on the muddy paths, through the towering stands of reed and papyrus, which closed overhead to form a cool, gloomy tunnel of living green stems. There were Cape buffalo, and twice he heard them crashing away through the papyrus without a glimpse of them. There were hippopotamus and crocodile, but they spent the days deep in the dark reed-fringed lakelets and mysterious lily-covered pools. At night he often woke and huddled in his blanket to listen to their harsh, grunting bellows resounding through the swampland. One noonday, sitting on a low promontory of rocky, wooded ground that thrust into the swamp, he watched a white rhinoceros bring its calf out of the sheltering reeds to feed on the edge of the bush. She was a huge old female, her pale grey hide scarred and scratched, folded and wrinkled over the massive prehistoric body that weighed at least 4 tons, and she fussed over the calf anxiously, guiding it with her long, slightly curved-nosed horn. The calf was hornless and fat as a piglet. Watching the pair, Mark realized suddenly how deeply this place had touched his life, and the possessive love he was developing for it was reaffirmed. Here he lived as though he was the first man in all the earth, and it touched some deep atavistic need in his spirit. It was on that same day that he came upon recent signs of the other human presence beyond Charka's Gate. He was following one of the faint game paths that skirted another ridge, one of those that joined the main run of ground into the slopes of the escarpment when he came upon the spoor. It was barefooted, the flat-arched and broad soles of feet that had never been constricted by leather footwear. Mark went down on his knees to examine it carefully. Too big for a woman, he knew at once. The stride told him the man was tall, the gait was slightly toe-in, and the weight was carried on the ball of the foot, the way an athlete walks. There was no scuff or drag of toe on the forward swing. A high lift and a controlled transfer of weight, a strong, quick, alert man, moving fast and silently. The spoor was so fresh that at the damp patch where the man had paused to urinate, the butterflies still fluttered in a brilliant cloud for the moisture and salt. Mark was very close behind him, and he felt the hunter's thrill, as without hesitation he picked up and started to run the spoor. He was closing quickly. The man he was following was unaware. He had paused to cut a green twig from a wild loquat branch, probably to use as a toothpick, and the shavings were still wet and bleeding. Then there was the place where the man had paused, turned back on his own spoor a single pace, paused again, almost certainly to listen, then turned abruptly off the path. Within 10 more paces the spoor ended, as though the man had launched into flight, or been lifted into the sky by a fiery chariot. His disappearance was almost magical, and though Mark worked for another hour, casting and circling, he found no further sign. He sat down and lit a cigarette, and found he was sweaty and disgruntled. Although he had used all his bushcraft to come up with his quarry, he had been made to look like an infant. The man had become aware of Mark following, probably from 1,000 yards off, and he had jinked and covered his spoor, throwing the pursuit with such casual ease that it was a positive insult. As he sat, Mark felt his ill-humour harden and become positive hard anger. "Yeah, I'll get you yet," he promised the mysterious stranger aloud. And it did not even occur to him what he might do if he ever did come up with his quarry. All that he knew was that he had been challenged, and he had taken up the challenge. The man had the cunning of... Mark sought for a simile, a properly disparaging simile, and then grinned as he found a suitable one. The man had the cunning of a jackal, but he was Zulu, so Mark used the Zulu word, Pungushi. "I'll be watching for you, Pungushi. I'll catch you yet, little jackal." His mood improved with the insult, and as he crushed out his cigarette, he found himself anticipating the contest of bush skills between himself and Pungushi. Now, whenever Mark moved through the wilderness, part of his attention was alert for the familiar footprints in the soft, earthy places, or for the glimpse of movement and the figure of a man among trees. 3 times more he cut the spoor, but each time it was cold and wind-eroded, not worth following. The days passed in majestic circle of sky and mountain, of sun and river and swamp, so that time seemed without end until he counted on his fingers and realized that his month was almost run. Then he felt the dread of leaving, a sinking of the spirits such as a child feels when the moment of return to school comes at the end of an idyllic summer holiday. That night he returned to the camp below the fig tree with the last of the light, and set his rifle against the stem of the tree. He stood a moment, stretching aching muscles and savouring the coming pleasure of hot coffee and a cheerful fire, when suddenly he stooped and then dropped on one knee to examine the earth, soft and fluffy with leaf mould. Even in the bad light there was no mistaking the print, broad bare feet. Quickly Mark looked up and searched the darkening bush about him, feeling an uneasy chill at the knowledge that he might be observed at this very moment. Satisfied at last that he was alone, he backtracked the spoor, and found that the mysterious stranger had searched his camp, had found the pack in the tree and examined its contents, then returned them carefully, each item to its exact place, and replaced the pack in the tree. Had Mark not seen the spoor in the earth, he would never have suspected that his pack had been touched. It left him disquieted and ill at ease to know that the man he had tracked and followed had been tracking and probably watching him just as carefully, and with considerably greater success rewarding his efforts. Mark slept badly that night, troubled by weird dreams in which he followed a dark figure that tap-tapped with a staff on the rocky, dangerous path ahead of him, drawing slowly away from Mark without looking back, while Mark tried desperately to call him to wait. But no sound came from his straining throat. In the morning he slept late, and rose dull and heavy-headed, to look up into a sky filled with slowly moving, cumbersome ranges of dark, bruised, cumulus cloud that rolled in on the southeast wind from off the ocean. He knew soon it would rain, and that he should be going. His time had run, but in the end he promised himself a few last days, for the old man's sake and his own. It rained that morning before noon, a mere taste of what was to come, but still a quick, cold, grey, drenching downpour that caught Mark without shelter. Even though the sun poured through a gap in the clouds immediately afterwards, Mark found that the cold of the rain seemed to have penetrated his bones, and he shivered like a man with palsy in his sodden clothing. Only when the shivering persisted long after his clothes had dried did Mark realise that it was exactly 22 days since his first night under the fig tree and his first exposure to the river mosquitoes. Another violent shivering fit caught him, and he realized that his life probably depended now on the bottle of quinine tablets in the pack high in the branches of the fig tree, and on whether he could reach it before the malaria struck with all its malignance. It was 4 miles back to the camp, and he took a short route through thick thorn and over a rocky ridge to intersect the path again on the far side. By the time he cut the path, he was feeling dizzy and light-headed, and he had to rest a moment. The cigarette he lit tasted bitter and stale, and as he ground the stub under his heel, he saw the other spoor in the path. In this place it had been protected from the short downpour of rain by the dense spread branches of a mahuba-khuba tree. It overlaid his own outward spoor, moving in the same direction as he had, but the thing that shocked him was that the feet that had followed his had been booted and shod with hobnails. They were the narrower, elongated feet of a white man. There seemed in that moment of sickness on the threshold of malaria to be something monstrously sinister in those booted tracks. Another quick fit of shivering caught Mark, and then passed, leaving him momentarily clear-headed and with the illusion of strength, but when he stood to go, his legs were still leaden. He had gone another 500 yards back towards the river, when a day-flighting owl called on the ridge behind him, at the point where he had just crossed. Mark stopped abruptly and tilted his head to listen. A tsetse fly bite at the back of his neck began to itch furiously, but he stood completely still as he listened. The call of the owl was answered by a mate, the fluting hoot-hoot, skilfully imitated, but without the natural resonance. The second call had come from out on Mark's right, and a new chill that was not malaria rippled up his spine as he remembered the hooting owls on the escarpment above Ladyburg on that night so many months ago. He began to hurry now, dragging his heavy, almost disembodied legs along the winding path. He found that he was panting before he had gone another 100 yards, and that waves of physical nausea flowed upwards from the pit of his belly, gagging in his throat as the fever tightened its grip on him. His vision began to break up, starring and cracking, like shattered mosaic work, irregular patches of darkness edged in bright, iridescent colours, with occasional flashes of true vision, as though he looked out through gaps in the mosaic. He struggled on desperately, expecting at any moment now to feel the spongy swamp grass under his feet and to enter the dark, protective tunnels of papyrus, which he knew so well, and which would screen him and direct him back to the old camp. An owl hooted again, much closer this time, and from a completely unexpected direction. Confused and now frightened, Mark sank down at the base of a knobthorn tree to rest and gather his reserves. His heart was pounding against his ribs, and the nausea was so powerful as almost to force him to retch, but he rode it for a moment longer, and miraculously his vision opened as though a dark curtain had been drawn aside, and he realized immediately that in his fever blindness he had lost the path. He had no idea where he was now, or the direction in which he was facing. Desperately, he tried to relate the angle of the sun, or slope of the ground, or find some recognizable landmark, but the branches of the knobthorn spread overhead, and all around him the bush closed in, limiting his vision to about 50 paces. He dragged himself to his feet and turned up the rocky slope, hoping to reach high ground, and behind him an owl hooted, a mournful funereal sound. He was blind and shaking again when he fell, and he knew he had torn his shin, for he could feel the slow, warm trickle of blood down his ankle. But it seemed unrelated to his present circumstances, and when he lifted his hand to his face, it was shaking so violently that he could not wipe the icy sweat from his eyes.